Today, Australia's two time bombs. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, where I'm the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hello, Tarek.
Hey, Martin, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good. You hanging in there?
Yeah, mate, that's all you can do, isn't it? You know, these are the times.
One day at a time, as they say. Certainly, there are some, you know, interesting developments, although the rate may be slowing a little. I think the clamp on movement and, you know, all the interaction is going to go on for quite some time.
Yeah, even some of the more conservative estimates I've seen from people are talking about, you know, sort of limits on movement and social distancing well past winter. So we could be looking at easily 6 months from now before we start to see any sort of real return to normal.
Yeah, well, I keep saying, remember that the vaccine is 18 months away. So if you like, we may make some decisions about more or less between now and again. But, you know, this is still going to be around for some time. So we have to take the long road, I'm afraid.
Absolutely. That's really the key element that we're facing at the moment. It's just it is a situation that is just absolutely filled with unknowns. You know, things that we thought were true a week ago aren't. Things that we thought were true 2 weeks ago now seem farcical. And that's really where we're at. You know, I mean, you had Trump in February saying that criticism of his handling of everything was a hoax. And obviously that's been proven disastrously wrong.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how people are changing their tunes very quickly and, you know, to the downside. And it's also interesting how now some of the financial analysts who were talking about the stock market bouncing back, you know, V-shaped, very short, they're now changing their tune as well, thinking, well, hang on a moment, until we actually know what the duration of this thing really is, trying to value companies on a future cash flow basis is impossible. So therefore, how can you value anything? So basically, anybody who's in the market at the moment is purely speculating.
Absolutely. There was an interview Raoul Powell did for Real Vision recently, and he, in his view, sickly where we're at. And I can't really find anything to disagree with him, because they're at sort of rather serious risks to the downside, and we have no idea what the upside scenario even is yet.
Well, you know, we know we're going to end up with more debt, and that's going to be public debt and private debt. We know that there are going to be probably less businesses around than there were beforehand, and we know that unemployment rates are going to be higher for some time. So those are the things we do know. Trying to put a positive spin on all of that is actually quite difficult.
Absolutely. I mean, if you actually look at the sort of the initial jobless claims coming out of Canada and the US, they are just horrendous. You know, I mean, in Canada has already exceeded its GFC unemployment high. If you extrapolate out off initial jobless, what are the figures? 11% of the Canadian labor force lost their jobs in 16 days. Canada already had 5.6% unemployment, so they're already looking at 16.6% unemployment, and not everyone qualifies for those unemployment benefits either, so the number could actually be somewhat higher. And so we're already looking at GFC-level unemployment rates. I mean, in the US, the nationally 6.6% of the workforce has lost their jobs, so they're already looking at about almost 10% unemployment, which is roughly around about the GFC peak. However, some analysts, in particular Jim Bianco, has come out and they've put out these charts for the unemployment, the initial jobless claims on a state-by-state basis. And in the state of Pennsylvania, which is considered to have one of the most efficient labor offices, they had 12.98% of workers become unemployed in the past 14 days. So they're already heading towards Great Depression-era level unemployment. And yet here in Australia, we still, you know, maintain this idea that somehow we're going to be fine, that somehow we're different. Like, there was an article in the Fairfax Media yesterday, and it was just, you know, the only realism in there was Steve Keen. And, you know, Steve Keen saying 20%, but it's already, you know, we're already pushing 16% in Canada, 10% in the US. 20% isn't really that much of a stretch, given another couple of weeks.
Well, it's interesting because Westpac, of course, last week or the week before said 17%. And then when the ScoMo's latest package came out, which effectively means giving people who are employed money to keep them effectively attached to their firms, which means they're not theoretically unemployed, then the number goes down to 9%. But that's a really artificial number because they're still not working. They're still off the job, as it were, but they're actually still, in theory, at least connected to their firms. So in a way, we are sort of smearing a little bit of truth over those figures, in my view.
We realistically need to work out how many people are actually unemployed in order to actually have a proper response to this. For business leaders and government to be able to come together and go, okay, this is what's required. But if the JobKeeper payment is going to mask the true scale of the issue, then we're really flying blind. And I think the JobKeeper program isn't really going to be as effective as they claim, because it requires companies to pay their staff 1 month and then they get the reimbursement from the government. Now, if you're a sort of small business with maybe sort of 5 to 10 employees, you know, that means having tens of thousands of dollars worth of cash on you to be able to have the cash flow to pay your employees to then get it back from the ATO. Now, under normal circumstances or even a garden variety recession, that's probably pretty doable. But when all these businesses have absolutely no positive cash flow whatsoever, it may be just asking far too much of them.
Yeah, but you saw the ABA announcement yesterday, which said, of course, the banks will be happy to bridge the gap and allow businesses to borrow to be able to then get repayment from the government down the track. So they're going to help.
Are they, though? Are they? I mean, I've spoken to multiple business owners and they've said that they've been knocked back by the banks. Yeah. You know, people who've had, you know, very, very, you know, I've spoken to some startup owners, you know, who have some very, very high profile investors. Some of them have CEOs with, you know, sorry, chairmen of the board who used to run billion-dollar companies, and they're still struggling to get loans from the banks.
Yep.
So I really do question exactly how it is in reality versus the sort of super happy fun time narrative.
Well, I can tell you from my surveys, about half of those mortgage holders going to the bank and trying to get an extension on their mortgage repayments are unsuccessful at the moment. And about one third of small businesses who tried to get help have been able to get it. The other two thirds so far have been unable to. And so, there's a difference between, if you like, the hope over expectation.
You know, why people are being denied these mortgage pauses or loans for small businesses?
Yeah, well, it seems to be a couple of things. Firstly, the banks are still applying some degree of responsible lending criteria. So they're making a risk-based assessment, firstly. And secondly, you have to prove that your business or your circumstances are actually being adversely impacted. And in some cases, the adverse impact is not sufficient to be able to warrant the help.
Sounds like something that's filled with shades of grey rather than the black and white we're told on. You know, you've got Anna Blythe saying 98% of businesses are going to be covered and all this other business, but I mean, that doesn't sound like anywhere near 98%.
Well, we'll see how it beds in, but certainly not at the moment. And what's interesting, of course, is that, again, my surveys show that in many cases it's already happened. So in other words, people already lost their jobs and there's now a sort of scrabbling around to say, well, what do I do? And a lot of small businesses are self-employed or, you know, part-time businesses or contractor type businesses or gig type businesses weren't going to be helped anyway. So they're really struggling. Cash flow is the critical issue. That's why I was advocating a more universal basic income as a way of dealing with this. In other words, getting money direct into the hands of households and businesses urgently to be able to at least provide some means of visible support, sort of going indirectly via the banking system and all those other things and via companies, seems to me it's not very clever at all. It's just taking too long.
Oh, well, that's the thing. It is very clever from a political perspective, not from a practical one. You know, like you see all these various analyses of all the various programs that are being engaged around the world. And one of the major criticisms of Australia's is that it's targeted businesses. It's not targeted at individuals. So there's this entire extra layer of bureaucracy and qualifying for it and all this other sort of stuff, which really isn't all that helpful. What we need now, as you say, is cash in the hands of people right now to be able to keep the economy afloat until we're able to actually come out of this, whenever that ends up being. But, I mean, to look at it from a rather cynical political perspective, realistically, it's to mask the unemployment rate. It's for Scott Morrison to be able to say for the next 6 months or however long this ends up lasting, that, oh, no, 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 we're not like everyone else. Australia's different. We're like a lucky country, and our unemployment is in single digits while you're all up around, what did Fed President Bullard say, 32.7%?
Yeah. And of course, you could argue the same about APRA's redefinition of what it means to be delinquent. So effectively, if you don't, if you have that mortgage repayment holiday, you're not delinquent. So that means they don't have to report delinquencies, so they won't be high. So pretty much everywhere, what we're doing is form over substance, right? What we're doing is trying to manipulate the top level and to manipulate the data. But the reality on the ground, I think, is really quite different and quite worryingly so. And yet, according to the latest opinion polls, ScoMo is doing very well.
Well, it's rally around the flag. It's just absolutely just people just looking at things, and it's a crisis. Opinion polls improve. I mean, you look at Trump approval rating ever at the moment, and his mistakes will ultimately end up costing Americans tens of thousands of lives and probably trillions of dollars. Yet people look at him and they go, oh, what he's doing such a fantastic job. And I think a key part of that is the media. Because the only people who right now who have a lower approval rating than Trump and Congress is the media by a significant margin. People just don't believe us anymore. And to be completely honest with you, I don't really blame them. And while I don't think Australia is anywhere near as far down the road as the US is, we are starting to see the same sort of political tribalism and people backing the leader that we see in America. And realistically, I don't really see any end to that anytime soon.
No, I think that's probably right. And as you say, in a crisis, people tend to rally around the flag and rally around whoever's in charge. But I still think there needs to be a little bit of thoughtful analysis of what's really going on, and not just effectively sucking up to the top level narrative, whatever that may be. And going back to your point about the two ticking time bombs, obviously unemployment's one. What's the other one?
It's immigration. It's the fact that we're going to see a reversal in temporary migration to a rather significant degree. And it's also the fact that net overseas migration is going to be reduced. Now, obviously, temporarily, that's going to be as a result of the current conditions. And probably for the next 6 or 12 months, we're going to see that be quite muted compared with the sort of normal levels of 200,000 to 300,000. But we're also going to see serious political pressure placed on Scott Morrison and whoever ends up in government after him. And because you can't continue a large immigration program like we've had. It's fine when you've got 5% unemployment, but when it's 10 or 15 behind the scenes, it's not going to be politically possible. It's going to be political suicide. Now, if a third-party alternative rises, which in these sort of circumstances, someone usually does, even if they don't make it into government, there's going to be sufficient pressure on the government to be forced to curtail immigration and to be more reasonable. But just on the topic of temporary migration, I went through the Home Affairs website, and they're all their various data on the number of temporary migrants in Australia. And believe it or not, the number of temporary migrants in Australia is already down 10%. 240,000 temporary migrants have already left the country, including 141,000 international students, 11,000 Kiwis, and 17,000 skilled visa holders. Now, this is based on my extrapolation of the March quarter figures because they're incredibly seasonal due to the student numbers and people going home over Christmas. But if you actually look even at the latest data from Home Affairs, the number that it's been reduced is even larger. If you go off the data from end of quarter 2019, so sort of December 31st, we are already down 260,000 temporary visa holders. And that's an enormous number. And if we see that continue, as we've previously discussed, and maybe 20, 30% leave, you're removing, somewhere between 1 and 3% of the population. And that's going to be an enormous economic hit that's going to be stretched out as people continue their exodus over time. But it's also going to be a big hit into housing, because you're going to have all of this extra property, potentially years of property at 70,000 per people per year if we reduce our immigration. And what happens then? We have one of the biggest property supplies in recent history.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, of course, the other point there is that we already expect property prices to begin to slide from this point. International demand has pretty much fallen off the planet. There's nobody looking at property more generally. So effectively, it's all looking pretty much the same, which is that it's going to be pretty negative, I think. So, yeah, it's another very important factor.
Yeah, I was going to ask you because I think one of the key factors that's going to guide the sort of response to this, to the stimulus, to the crisis in terms of stimulus, basically how much headroom the government's going to have in their budget. So I was wondering sort of what's the ballpark figure that you've come up with or you've heard thrown around in terms of how much a bank bailout could cost in Australia if we have a sort of island GFC-esque experience?
Well, difficult to know, of course, because the Reserve Bank has thrown everything at it, kitchen sink and all the plumbing, couple of washing machines as well, probably, to be able to support the banking system, right? So if you look at the the funding cost, that's very, very low. If you look at the committed liquidity facility, that's still there. There's lots of other things that they're doing. So it's going to be really, really hard to try and understand what it would take, because I think what they're doing is whatever else happens in the real economy, I think the banking system is going to go through this very well, simply because of all the support that's there.
Really? Because, I mean, I was thinking, man, if we reach, you know, sort of 10-15% unemployment over, say, a 2-3 year time horizon, I mean, the Congressional Budget Office in the US is talking about US unemployment still being at 9% by the end of next year. And, I mean, even the kook recently said that if we had unemployment above 6%, that it was going to cause problems for the banks and problems for housing prices. So, I mean, I just sort of don't really know how all that washes out in the end.
I'm not sure anybody does. According to the stress test that APRA did, the banks can swallow that no problem at all, even without any support from the government, despite the fact that, of course, now the Reserve Bank has done what it's done. They've released some of the capital buffers. They've basically given them everything. The only thing they haven't done here is to tell them not to pay dividends. So in the UK and in some other countries, the regulators have told the banks not to pay dividends because they need the capital. They haven't done that here yet.
Well, I think that's going to be really interesting to watch the banks going forward because yep. Was at Wells Fargo the other day. They came out and said that they're no longer going to offer large mortgages, yep. What they consider to be large by American standards, which is probably significantly lower than what we consider to be large.
Yeah, $730,000 is a jumbo loan in the US.
Well, there you go. But they're even refusing to refinance customers with these jumbo loans unless they have $150,000 of liquid assets in the bank. So, I mean, it really makes me wonder how much longer it's going to be before we see the sort of a similar tightening of credit here in Australia as a response to this, because while the banks, I'm sure they would love to just go absolutely ballistic and then just hope for the bailout, it seems like they're at least trying to be prudent.
Yeah, well, they're actually being much tighter on new loans. So effectively, I've heard a number of stories that loans that were, agreed in principle won't now go ahead. That's already happening. The non-banks are doing that now, and some of the others too. But they are actually extending credit to existing borrowers to help them through and essentially applying various hardship schemes and other mechanisms to try and actually protect households because, of course, they don't want to have a bad loan on their books because that then would require some higher levels of capital and then it folds into higher provisions and all those things that follow. So what we're trying to see, I think what we're seeing at the moment is the banks effectively preserving their lending capacity and their capital to protect their portfolio that they've currently got with the expectation that they'll be able to keep doing that for quite some time. And so my own expectation is that while the growth of new loans will be pretty anemic from this time, I expect the total loan portfolios to continue to grow. It's interesting because remember that we've got some of the highest loan to income ratios and GDP ratios in the world. I think at the end of this, we're probably going up with even bigger numbers.
Wow. That's all I can say. Wow. I mean, yep. I don't know. Like, I mean, I look at things and I just sort of see the struggles going on and I have a hard time seeing how they don't end up with enormous arrears and defaults and, you know, sort of houses on their books.
Well, what's interesting is they're not required to revalue property in their books. And of course, in the UK, the banks lobbied the government to stop all house sales and all house transactions because they didn't want to have home price values starting to decrease so that would have to be recognised in any of their records. So there's some really funny stuff going on. So I think the banks will probably get through this in a surprisingly good shape. The question will be, what about everybody else?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, that's what we're seeing at the moment. It's, you know, this crisis is the complete opposite of the GFC. That was something that began in the financial world and then affected the real economy. And now we're seeing something that's absolutely smashing the real economy.
Yeah, no, my point is simply that that clearly the government and the banks are on the same side of the ledger, right? So effectively it's them supporting each other and basically making sure that they're fine. Then the question is, how does that fall out into the real economy and real households and real businesses? And I guess we'll know down the track, but I think it's going to be a bit bumpy.
So do you think it's realistically going to be enough? You know, I mean, if we do see 20-25% unemployment?
Well, you know, it depends on how that is distributed. There's a risk that it won't. But again, if you think of the amount of money that's been thrown directly and indirectly, and also the very low rates to borrow, so basically the RBA can go on doing that for a long time at 0.25%. That allows them plenty of latitude. So we'll see. I don't know.
So you reckon there's sort of, you know, a fair scope to for them to come out of this, even with sort of, you know, Great Depression 2.0?
I think we'll find that some of the smaller ones will get gobbled up in the process. But I suspect that our major, you know, large players will just sell through as though, oh, what happened there? Did I hit something?
Wow. I must admit, I didn't expect that. I mean, I would have thought that it would have just been sort of, you know, the iceberg would have been too big for the Titanic, to speak.
Well, if you'd asked me that 6 weeks ago, I'd have said the same, but that was before they threw everything, literally everything at them.
I mean, considering that they're, you know, sort of throwing the kitchen sink and a couple of washing machines, as you say, I mean, what do you sort of realistically think this could potentially do to the dollar over time if the amount of mini bailouts that they need, it continues to grow?
Yeah, but everyone's doing it. Right. So if in the local crisis, the dollar would have been hit. But because it's happening everywhere and we've still got our resource base, my own feeling is that we probably will see the dollar quite close to where it is. It might be slightly lower, but I don't think it'll be dramatically lower. Yeah.
Yeah.
So everyone's going up. Everyone's going down.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that, you know, sort of like the housing side of things is something that we're going to be looking at in the sort of longer term. I mean, you know, it's all, I mean, obviously, if you're correct, and I think that there's, you know, after you've explained it, I think there's a fairly good chance that you might be, especially in the short term regarding the banks. I mean, realistically, that then sort of postpones any housing crisis, you know, housing price crash that we may have, you know, sort of into next year.
Yep.
And until we sort of see that unemployment realized without the government scaffolding, yep, supporting households.
The question is, what happens when they take the visible support away? That's the key question, right? I don't think they'll be able to take it away after 6 months. They'll have to taper it. So I would expect more government support for, you know, 9 months, a year, 18 months. That's my idea. What we're seeing.
Well, yeah, I think that the sort of, you know, health crisis support is going to evolve into sort of the economic crisis support, and then, you know, the tail end of economic crisis support, because, I mean, I wrote an article about this in Spectator a few days ago, and basically I can't see them being able to take away, you know, the mortgage holidays, all these various support, you know, these scaffolding measures, without it all just immediately falling in a heap the very next day. And basically, you know, sort of having this phenomenon where you've got all the various bad news they've managed to postpone, and then all of a sudden in a single week or a single month, it's like, oh, unemployment's gone up, you know, sort of 5, 6, 7, 10%.
Yep.
And, you know, sort of 100,000 businesses have collapsed.
That's exactly right. And that's why I'm saying it'll be tapered. You know, this will go on for a lot longer than people are expecting. And of course, if you're in the MMT world, they don't care about that because, you know, debt's not a problem. As long as it's creating constructive momentum in the economy, then it's all fine. So we'll see.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? We're well and truly in uncharted territory. You know, MMT, negative rates, QE infinity.
Yep.
Who knows?
Like I said, a wide selection of kitchen sinks. Help yourself and just carry on.
Yeah. Well, they've got a hell of a lot more than I thought. You know, they've literally gone to an entire Bunnings and got, you know, filled up the car.
Well, yeah, but the point is, you know, if you follow MMT, there's no limit. Literally, there is no limit.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure about MMT, to be honest. I watched an interview with Jared Minnick about it, and he made a sort of fairly compelling argument as to how it could be done on a smaller scale in a country with a large and productive industrial base, like, yep, say, Japan. They could, you know, a hit to their currency could be something favourable. But for us, I'm not so sure.
Well, the critical thing about MMT is you need to make productive investment from the money, right? Mm. That's the critical thing, productive investment. And I don't think this is necessarily productive investment. This is basically sticking plaster, elastoplast and string, trying to hold things together. And that's the problem. So you end up with a big debt, but not something out the back of it. This is actually adding extra value. And if that's true, then this could be a major mistake.
Well, that's I have a similar view, even with, like, you know, JobKeeper and everything else. Like you say, it's a Band-Aid solution, but it's also a false sense of security for people. You know, it gives people the idea that there's a job to go back to. And I think that's a really key thing that we're seeing at the moment. You know, here in Australia, we're not being given the whole truth. We're being told that we're different, that JobKeeper is going to save us, that all these, you know, that all these unemployment forecasts are nothing like the ones coming out of Europe or America or Canada, and that somehow we're going to be okay. And I think people are in for a rude awakening as time goes on and as the rest of the world basically starts to fall to bits.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And, you know, we are so reliant on the international economy, including the US and China. So, yeah, it's going to be tricky, definitely tricky. And I think, you know, my conclusion on all this, it's going to take a lot longer. It's going to take a lot of debt. And then the question is, what do we do with it?
Yeah, I'm sort of wondering, are we going to see something along the lines of basically in they kill the financial system, trying to save everything? They basically just blow it all up, you know, trying to save asset prices, trying to save the system as it is, when realistically they should just be letting asset prices get smashed and then just picking up the pieces afterwards, and then we'd be much better off.
Yeah, well, central banks aren't prepared to do that. So central banks are betting on financial stability above everything else. And, you know, we're seeing that from the Fed, we're seeing it from the Bank of England, from the RBA. The question is, can you support the financial system to the extent that's required and still have an economy left at the end of it? And that, of course, is the big experiment that nobody knows the answer to.
No, we don't. And I think that's the problem. You know, we have these two very distinct things that are trying to be supported, the real economy and the financial system. And one thing I just thought was just incredibly stupid, especially in America, is that there's more support and more easily accessible support heading towards the financial system than there is heading towards households who are going to be getting smashed by this for the foreseeable future. And, you know, there's no real sort of long-term safety net yet in place, despite the fact that they've already blown through trillions and trillions of dollars.
Yeah, well, in the US, the mortgage-backed security sector is now asking for support. Here in Australia, the superannuation sector is asking for support. So all of the elements that make up the financial system are all doing the same.
Yeah, I read about all these different people sticking their hands out and stuff, and honestly, it makes me rather frustrated, to be completely honest with you, because, you know, I think about some of the statistics and some of the things I've written about over the years. Like, you know, there's 116,000 homeless Australians as of the 2016 census, and it just sort of really gets up my goat quite a bit, that the fact that, you know, these people are so low on the rungs of, you know, requiring help, but, you know, you've got the real estate industry and everyone else who's done very, very well in recent years sticking their hands out.
Yeah. Well, I did an interview with Michael Hudson, who's a very famous economist from the US, and he makes the point that the more that you put money into the financial system and support the financial system, the less is available for everybody else. And so it's a complete tilting of, if you like, the economic pie towards the 10% or the 1%, and they're going to be fine. But the problem is that there's a spillover effect, a very negative spillover effect, into everybody else. And unfortunately, the everybody else just get less and less and less and become more and more disadvantaged. And that is, I think, a very good summary of where we are.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, and I think one of the things, I mean, you know, my girlfriend made this point years ago to me, and she said, if the 1% keep getting a larger and larger slice of the pie, and that's obviously what's happening now, you know, they're going to destroy the consumer economy, because if you don't give consumers enough money to consume, they can't. And basically the engine of the economy stops. You know, we have a services-based consumer economy. And if you take away the consumer's, you know, sort of disposable income, it doesn't matter how much asset prices go up, the real economy is basically going to fall over, and then it's not going to matter anymore, because, you know, you can't have earnings per share if there are no earnings.
No, that's exactly right. So half of the Australian economy is consumer-led. It's about 70% in the US. And so the question is, what's after that? And that'll be another very interesting question for another day.
Yeah, I think that's probably going to be a series of questions over a few weeks, I would imagine. Yeah, I think it's really sort of a long-term view. I mean, you know, it's the sort of, you know, sort of very, very critical calls at the moment saying that, you know, we're going to see like housing prices crashing and stuff in the very near future. And I think with limited transactions and, as you say, with extreme levels of government support, and the fact is, I mean, anyone who can get a mortgage holiday at the moment, we're not going to be looking at a serious increase in arrears on that, in, you know, until the end of the year, realistically. So, I mean, I think the housing story might be something that's more next year than this year, realistically.
Yeah, well, I model over 2 or 3 years because I think that's the time frame to think about it, and they'll be down. But yes, I tend to agree. I don't think it's going to necessarily crash immediately, and of course, the volumes will be very low. Well, you know, as always, we always come to the end of our thinking, our conversations, thinking there's a lot going on. And guess what? There's a lot going on.
always, mate. And I mean, I said in one of our first chats that we, you know, like the old Chinese curse/proverb, may you live in interesting times. And my God, has that been true over the last few months?
Absolutely. Well, I can guarantee that the next few months will be even more interesting. We'll check back in with you again, Tarek, and see how things are traveling. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, mate.